We often form our ideas, don't we, about something at a certain point in time, and they don't get reviewed very much.
It's true, and there's a confusing array of ideas out there, how to live.
And views change. And this chap's ideas that you've brought in have been causing all sorts of ruffled feathers in the chicken house of eco-thinking.
They certainly have. This is a book called Austerity Ecology and the Collapse Porn Addicts, A Defense of Growth, Progress, Industry and Stuff. And it's come right out of left field. It's a UK science writer called Lee Phillips.
And he's got form, Lee Phillips. He's been writing about science for The Guardian, I think, for a long time.
For Nature?
Independent
for science?
Nature.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Highly
yeah.
reputable.
Yeah. And as a journalist with Nature in the news section, what you do is read a whole stack of scientific papers and summarise what is the mood at the moment in a certain area. He's taken a break from that, sat down, and he's what he's reflecting on is as the title suggests, this whole genre of collapse. And he's looked
so
at...
So this is... I have friends who tell me this. You know, Rick, you have to be worried about this because in a minute, oil's running, coal's running out, the water will be gone, there's no air.
Yeah. Well, he takes a bunch of these books, bestsellers, Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, Climate versus Capitalism, books called The Long Emergency, Uncivilization, Against Civilization, Derek Jensen's Endgame, The Problem of Civilization, and he critically analyses them. And a common theme is they say is the term overshoot. We've overshot. We've gone beyond our limits. We're racing down a road at 60 miles an hour, about to go over a cliff. So the question he poses as he reads them is, well, when do they think we got things right? Where is this time when humans lived in some sort of balance?
Down in the valley, away from the cliff.
Well, exactly. But he's saying when. I mean, what are they thinking about? What are they aiming for? And of five authors in this particular bunch of books, he's got he mines seven different dates. So Naomi Klein in This Changes Everything initially says the 1970s before consumerism became absolutely rampant. Later on, she says 1776 when James Watt invented the steam engine and kickstarted the Industrial Revolution. And even earlier, she said pre-agricultural. A couple of others say the Amish, they've got it right. Someone else says pre-Cromwell. This is Paul Kingsnorth, whose book was long listed for the Booker Prize.
Always felt Cromwell ruined everything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
with his hatred of Christmas. That was him, wasn't it?
Exactly. And then, but a couple of them go right back to the Stone Age. And the point he makes is you will never find a time when humans lived in this mythical balance with nature. Even if you go back to the Paleolithic, as Emma Maris says, the history of the world is... bunch of big animals, humans arrive, bunch of small animals. Not only do they get rid of the megafauna, but that dramatically changes the environment. It changes the vegetation. It subtly changes the climate.
Humans, we eat things. I mean, that's what happens, isn't it?
That's what we do.
Growing up in New Zealand, the constant debate about when the moa went extinct.
Yeah.
And basically, it wasn't settlers. You know, it was the Maori. But they paddled there themselves, and they introduced animals and things. So people have been moving around the world, introducing different plants and species and animals forever.
That's what we do. But to make the point that there is no such thing as this mythical, pristine balance of nature, he's got a lovely chapter called The Great Primordial Flatulence of Doom. And this is an event that occurred 2.3 billion years ago when the first organisms... when photosynthesis first appeared and cyanobacteria started pumping out oxygen as a waste product of photosynthesis and poisoned the atmosphere for everything else because it was toxic to most other things that lived. Mm. But what they did is create an atmosphere that suits life as we know it. So where was the balance there? So, you know, there's another delightful chapter called Local Organic Hand-Spun Carrot Pants. And what he has a go there is this idea of locavore, of eating locally, consuming locally. And there's a book called The Locavore's Dilemma, The 10,000-Mile Diet, where they look at food, a couple of geographers, extensive look at different foods. 80% of the energy content is in production, less than 10% in the transport. And a really good example is New Zealand lamb. So Sainsbury's took New Zealand lamb off their shelves because people complained, oh, the food miles. Mm. But what they wanted to replace it with Welsh lamb. Now, Welsh lamb, you've got to keep them in sheds over winter and you feed them, hand feed them food. The energy content of producing Welsh lamb was way more than New Zealand lamb. The cost of transport was a tiny fraction of the total energy budget. So unless you do a full life cycle analysis, these different, you know, footprint analyses, food miles, the danger is they can be used by all sorts of people for all different ends. So New Zealand lamb is now back on the shelves in Selfridges.
It is back on the shelves because these people did this work.
Yes.
And that must be why the New Zealand bowlers, batsmen, are doing so well in the cricket. They've found had a bit of a meal of lamb and they've come back from their pathetic performance to turn in what could be a record-breaking century. Let's not get distracted. Okay, so I've spent my life...
Yeah.
I've given up my job in Sydney. I've moved to Tasmania, or I've been lucky to be born in Tasmania. I've got my bit of land and I feed myself and I feel very proud about my corrugated iron raised garden bed that Peter Kundal told me I should have. And I talk my friends through how the charcoal drains through the, and I pick my, I'm wasting my time, am I? This is not going to save the planet. I'm an idiot. I'm a fool, according to this man.
Those are your words.
Is that what he's saying?
What he does say is retreat is going to do very little for climate change. If you reduce the amount of meat you eat, if you stop flying, if you wear local organic hand-spun carrot pants, it's going to do vanishingly little for climate change. What we need is abundant sources of cheap energy. And individuals retreating are not going to do that, other than it's going to temporarily offset the guilt of the worried well. But what he's arguing for, above all, is to get us out of this hole, we need big, large-scale public investment in transition to the next form of energy.
It's 7:15 on 936 ABC Hobart. Ted Lefroy is director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania. And every month or so he comes in and just pops down a bit of an idea bomb about you and your relationship with the world around you, the environment. And he's discussing a book which looks at the idea of collapse. It's written by British science writer Lee Phillips. Now, this is where he goes on, Ted, to say, I think nuclear power is wonderful, and I started to want to work out who's paying this guy money.
He's giving one example of a transition, an energy transition. Okay, so France, Sweden and Belgium in the 1970s, publicly funded, made a transition to largely nuclear power. France now generates 78% of its electricity from nuclear power. Its energy emissions are falling, its GDP is growing. There are very few economies in the world that have decoupled like that. Everybody else, carbon emissions are in lockstep with GDP. We all took a hit in 2008 with the global financial crisis, and that is a view of this degrowth world, if you want to go there. But the point he makes is, we didn't run out of whale blubber. We switched to kerosene. The Stone Age didn't end for want of stones. People found copper or learned how to use metals. And similarly, the chances are the fossil fuel epoch will not end because we run out of fossil fuel, because we switch to abundant, cheaper sources of energy. Now,
like coal seam gas, for example, which in the States has had a big impact. But
no, it's still a fossil fuel.
He says, you know, modern nuclear power is so wonderful and it's so safe and it's so great. And in one article critiquing him, it says, well, Yokohama, come on. What about Japan?
Fukushima, exactly.
Fukushima.
Yeah, exactly. But if we were to say that those accidents in the past mean that we never go there again, it's an argument of risk, okay? I can say with a certain degree of confidence that about 40 people will die, 40 Tasmanians will die next year in road accidents.
Yes.
It's about 1 in 10,000. That's been the pattern. We accept that risk. That's part of accepting our modern lifestyle. But when there is a thing about nuclear power, because it is unseen, it's insidious, the radiation, but for most people, I mean, you can read all the arguments for and against, but I think we've just got to get over that, because we are in the situation of the lesser of two evils. And the point he's really making is, since the 80s, when we went out of a period of big governments into a sort of neoliberal, much more free market capitalism, it's almost like we're waiting on a boy wonder to solve it for us, or a girl wonder. Is Elon Musk going to rescue us? And really, that level of investment, as ingenious as those people are, is never going to be enough. So his argument really is for it's for going back to big government, for what you might call social democratic economic planning. And so can I just read you one little bit? Because he's great with language and he loves the hyphen. The anti-consumerist, back to the land, small is beautiful, civilization-hating, progress-questioning ideology of degrowth, limits and retreat is dominating not just the green left but the political spectrum. Far from being central to progressive thought, this cauldron of seething, effervescent misanthropy is utterly foreign to the rich tradition of humanism on the left and must be thoroughly excised from our ranks. So he's making it very clear. He's from the left. He's very disillusioned with the way the left is in retreat. Everybody's talking about collapse and doom. And he's saying there's nothing wrong with growth. It's capitalism, or it's the free market neoliberal capitalism that is more of a problem than growth itself.
The idea of saying get the governments out of there and let other people just sort things out, because individuals can't operate on a scale that we need people to deal with our energy needs.
Exactly.
What about solar, though, Ted Lefroy? What about all those other alternative forms of energy? Could not, in a similarly socially democratic, centrally organised way, we achieve mass energy outcomes without having to go through a nuclear transition?
Possibly. You know, we had a thing called...
Leave that stuff in the ground.
No. Yes, possibly. We had a thing called the Energy Research and Development Corporation in Australia until the resources minister at the time, Warwick Parra, closed it down. He later lost his job as resources minister because they discovered he hadn't declared his shares in coal companies in the Parliamentary Register of Interests. Okay. Now, when that small R&D corporation was going, a couple of $1 million a year, Sydney University was one of the major innovators in the world in solar power, in photovoltaics. And that had a huge blow to innovation in Australia. That was only a modest level of public investment. But what he's saying is governments need to get back into that role if we're going to get out of this hole.
That it's the government needs to invest, whether it's nuclear, whether it's hydro, whether it's solar, that's centrally organised, centrally planned. If you want to save the planet, it's got to come from our political organisation.
And why that is so
contentious. Not from your compost.
That's right. And why that's contentious is we've had two spectacular examples, more than two, you know, Russia, China, Cambodia, of centrally organised autocratic socialism that have coloured the whole idea of central planning. I mean, with Reagan...
This is Pol Pot, you're saying. If you start talking about going backwards, eventually it's Pol Pot.
Yeah,
let's get rid of the watches, let's get rid of the motorbikes, let's just farm with a hoe.
Yeah. But what he's saying
is... That's the logical extension of that.
Exactly.
But also, is this the idea of the environmental left that says humans are bad, humans are a cancer killing the planet, the Matrix sort of view that we're somehow outside of this system?
Exactly. And that's the other interesting thing about this book. Apart from his argument about political economy and how we should organise ourselves, he goes back into history and looks for where this argument began. And ever since the Enlightenment, there's been a counter-Enlightenment. There have been people who... What he says is this is the latest episode in what has been an eternal battle between those who recognise within our species, while there is potential both for greatness and wickedness, overall, we are improving, and those who focus on our wickedness and believe us to have fallen long ago. And it's amazingly biblical, some of the quotes that he can extract out of this collapse.
The problem is, if you believe that we've gone too far, that we've crossed the line, then you give up hope.
Exactly.
You're like a cancer, Mr. Anderson.